Greetings, listeners. I'm Carla Golden, and I'm here with Ethan McCurdy. We are Top of the Noggin. That is NOGN, which stands for Neuroscience Outreach Group at NYU. And we're bringing you the latest and most exciting breakthroughs in neuroscience, with an emphasis on new studies, cutting-edge technology, and neuroscience and culture. Before we discuss the paper on today's docket, we'd like to acknowledge the recent killings of Black people that have affected the world, including many of us in academia. In response to this, we at Top of the Noggin have taken some time to reflect on the ways in which we can work towards eradicating racist systems in academia. One small way we're going to work towards this goal is to make sure we highlight Black neuroscientists in our coming episodes.
For today, we're going to go over a paper that we scheduled last month, published online in September 2019 in Nature Communications, titled Rapid Metabolic Shifts Occur During the Transition Between Hunger and Satiety in Drosophila melanogaster. Be sure to stick around for when we bring in Daniel Walensky, the first author of the study, for some Q&A later on in the show.
We all know that you derive energy from your food. You eat a carrot, and boom, there's that extra leg lift you needed to ride your bike. But nutrients and the smaller molecules that they break down into, i.e. their metabolites, don't just support our activity. They can also carry information and control gene expression, the folding and transport of proteins, and the transduction of signals.
The realization that nutrients do more than fuel our cells was only just discovered in the past decade. In fact, very little is known about how nutrients and their metabolites influence complex behaviors.
One such behavior is a transition from hunger to satiation. We know there are hormonal changes in the brain that drive this transition, but we don't know what role the metabolites of ingested nutrients play.
In this paper, Walensky and colleagues mapped the precise metabolite changes that occur during the transition between hunger to satiation in Drosophila melanogaster, or fruit flies. So, how did they do this?
To study metabolic changes that occur between hunger and satiety, the authors developed a feeding schedule to capture the transition between these two states using Drosophila models. Specifically, flies were fasted for 24 hours, such that they missed their evening and morning meals. On the following day, they were given either plain agar, essentially a gelatin derived from seaweed that's low in nutrients, or agar containing glucose. These were referred to as the fasted or refed states.
The authors studied the behavior of fasted and refed flies using a quantitative method that measures the feeding interactions of the proboscis. That is a specialized mouth structure that flies use to consume food. It looks similar to a straw. As one might expect, the flies that were fasted displayed more feeding interactions than the flies that had been starved, over 90% compared to only around 60%. The hungry flies also displayed a longer feeding duration compared to the refed flies. However, both the time interval between feeding events and the time it actually took for the flies to start their first meal was not statistically different between either population.
When we eat, we tend to have more energy. The authors knew from previous work that flies also have differences in energy state that can be tied to fasting or fed conditions. In flies, this has to do with the levels of circulating chemicals, like glucose levels. In their hands, the authors next wanted to assess which metabolites were changing between the fasted and refed state. To do this, they turned to ultra-high-performance liquid chromatography tandem mass spectroscopy, which uses liquid chromatography to separate out particles by weight, and mass spectroscopy to identify what they are. The authors collected the heads and bodies, so they could get as much sample as possible, of fasted and refed flies, and applied this technique to measure the metabolic profile in each sample condition.
Rather than rely on previous human-centric tools, or tools that looked at a single pathway at a time, the authors developed a more precise tool called FlyScape that would help them visualize whole networks. FlyScape draws on a publicly accessible database called the BioCyc, that's BIOCYC, Pathway Genome Database Collection, which is described as integrating previous sequence genomes with metabolic pathways. The authors combined the data from BioCyc with the gene annotations from FlyScape to visualize changes in metabolites across the sample conditions. This allowed them to map reactions between metabolites and interactions between metabolites and genes, including ones that encode enzymes.
The authors assess changes in key signatures of metabolism in the FACID and refed flies. The FACID flies had higher levels of metabolites, such as glutamate and alpha-ketoglutarate, as well as medium chains of fatty acids, all of which are readouts of the catabolism of fatty acids, indicating a breakdown of stored energy sources. However, the metabolites of the refed flies were dominated by acetyl-CoA, malate, and lactate, which indicate increased glucose availability as well as metabolites. This indicates that they are storing energy into glycogen. This is because some of the extra glucose, extra being the body's energy stores that aren't being tapped into, is stored as glycogen, while the other extra glucose is readily metabolized. In FACID flies, their glucose and glycogen stores are used up, so they have to tap into their energy banks of fatty acid.
Break out your Biology 101 textbooks, folks, because the authors also look at the Krebs, or TCA, which stands for tricarboxylic acid cycle, and is essentially the breakdown of acetyl-CoA, which itself comes from the breakdown of carbohydrates and other nutrients, to a compound called NADH, which in turn is used to produce ATP, an essential source of cellular energy. The authors found that nearly all the compounds they measured in the TCA cycle were higher in the refed compared to the fasted state. Together, these data illustrate that fasted flies rely on ketosis, or the breakdown of fatty acids, when they are shifting between the fed to an unfed state, and they rely on glucose metabolism when shifting from the unfed to the fed state.
These conclusions were drawn from the metabolic profiling performed on bodies of fasted and refed flies. But what about the heads? What would happen to the metabolites in the heads of flies when you switch between metabolic states? Compared to the bodies of flies, the heads are mostly made up of neurons and glia that form the brain.
Similar to the bodies, the metabolic profiling of the heads of refed flies showed higher amounts of metabolites related to glucose metabolism, which was also reflected at the transcriptional level, that is, the synthesis of mRNA from DNA. However, compared to the bodies, there were higher glucose metabolic changes in the heads following refeeding. This isn't particularly surprising, since it's known that a large percentage of metabolized glucose goes towards powering the brain.
One particularly interesting finding from this analysis of the heads was that the authors observed differences in neurotransmitters and their intermediates between the FACID and refed flies. GABA, glutamate, N-acetyl serotonin, and choline, the precursor for acetylcholine, all had increased levels in the refed flies compared to the FACID flies. On the other hand, higher levels of aspartate and N-acetyl aspartate were observed in FACID flies, indicative of oxidative stress. The differing levels in neurotransmitters could underlie changes in behavior and normal functioning of the brain.
To find out if these metabolic changes were reflected at the level of RNA in the brains of fasted and refed flies, they conducted an RNA-seq experiment. They found that transcriptional changes are consistent with the increased catabolism of amino acids and nucleotides that they observed in the metabolomics data and the higher availability of nutrients in refed flies. Using the tool they developed, FlyScape, they found that transcriptional changes affected networks that were also changed in the metabolomic data, lending more information about what these changes mean functionally.
In the RNA-seq experiment, they also included flies that were never fasted to see if the act of fasting itself had any effect on gene transcription. Interestingly, only 11 transcripts had the same expression in the refed and sated conditions, suggesting that fasting has a great effect on gene expression.
They next wanted to determine how the transition between hunger and satiety would be affected by a different kind of diet that would introduce different metabolites. They chose to examine the effects of a high sugar diet. This is an interesting question for any of us in the States, because Americans in particular are known to have high sugar diets and higher rates of obesity compared to other places in the world.
To model a high sugar diet, the authors used a diet composition at 30% sucrose and examined its effect on the metabolism of FACID and refed Drosophila bodies, compared to a control diet composition of only 5% sucrose. The authors observed some striking metabolic changes. In the control diet, dozens of types of metabolites display differing levels between fasting and refeeding. However, in the high sugar diet, lipid and energy category metabolites increased in both the fasting and refed state, including compounds that had previously been shown in different studies to increase in humans with obesity who fast. Interestingly, compared to the control diet, The authors observed that the variance in metabolite changes between the fasting and refed state was minimized when a high-sugar diet was introduced.
Next, the authors wanted to take a look at feeding behavior, which they did using the quantitative method we discussed earlier that measures feeding interactions. Compared to refed flies, fasted flies continued to seek out food more often on both a control and high-sugar diet. However, fasted flies spent less time eating on the high-sugar diet as compared to time spent on the control diet.
Finally, turning again to metabolic changes that occurred in the heads of flies, the authors asked what effect a high-sugar diet would have on metabolites in the brain. Similar to the metabolic profiling of the bodies under a high-sugar versus control diet, the authors observed that numerous, in this case 159, metabolites changed between fasted and refed states on a control diet across multiple classes of compounds. However, a high-sugar diet largely blunted the differences in changes between states, and rather, the changes in metabolites for fasted and refed largely resembled one another in this condition, just like in the bodies. So what did you think of this paper, Ethan?
I thought this was an interesting paper. It was certainly outside of my normal area of expertise, in that it was a blend of, you know, it, I think that obviously with when they're looking at the doing the transcriptional profiling, looking at metabolic changes in the brain, that's more in our wheelhouse. But sort of the nutrition aspect of it was very interesting.
Yes, absolutely. And using flies in general. I don't read that many fly papers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Is this our first?
I think this is. Yeah, we've done a lot of rodent studies, but yeah, it would be good for us to bring in some other model systems, I think.
Well, that's a good perspective. Yeah. So this is okay. So then, marking the first time we're discussing the fly as a model organism, which of course is used in neurobiology rather extensively.
Especially the fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster. Yeah, you know, there's it's high sample sizes. You can make tons of flies very quickly.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's easy to make transgenic models, I think. And not easy, but you know, easier than other model systems.
Oh, certainly. And it allowed them, you know, because they're using this particular model organism here, they're able to draw on some, you know, the previously published, what was it, the BioPsych database, and then create their own database. So I think it's you know, it's interesting how you can use sort of high throughput organisms to create these publicly accessible tools.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do like to jump the flashback to biochemistry as well. I did have to look up the TCA cycle again. It's neat that they're going along and measuring the various metabolites and nutrients from this cycle in their study. You know, that was kind of like a cool. It was like, oh, this is a nice application of classical biology into a really nice, well designed, interesting paper.
Yeah, I will admit I have not considered many of these. The sims while studying neuroscience, but I'm sure they interact in so many ways. Especially actually thinking about the fasted versus refed states that they were examining throughout the paper. In a lot of behavioral tasks, and ones that we've covered on this podcast, we limit the amount of food that they're eating so that food then becomes a reward that they'll work for. But, you know, it seems very clear that fasting an animal is going to affect their energy level and maybe also interact with these neurotransmitters that we're setting while they're making these, while they're performing this task. So,
it's such a good point.
It's important that we think about all these systems and how they interact all the time. And obviously we control for that in these studies. You know, all the groups we're comparing are fasted in the same way, but yeah. But you know, the body and the brain are interacting all the time. We have to remember that.
Yes, it's true. That's a good perspective. Shall we bring on Daniel to ask him some questions about the research? All right, Dr. Daniel Walensky is a postdoctoral fellow in the laboratory of Professor Monica Deuce at the University of Michigan. who is, by the way, a former postdoc in the laboratory of Greg Suh at NYU. Daniel did his PhD work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, studying RNA protein regulatory networks, and he is now studying metabolic changes in the brain as a result of diet.
Hi,
Daniel,
thanks.
Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, yeah. It's very nice to be here.
So we usually like to start at the beginning. With how did you get involved with science, and what is your background as a scientist?
That's a long and circuitous tale. I won't bore you with all the details, but I think I've always wanted to be a scientist. I just didn't exactly know what that meant. I remember in high school, I was taking a class, a biology class, and I was really bored. But my teacher thought, you know, I had some potential, perhaps. I'm not sure. But anyway, she bought me fruit flies and allowed me to do experiments in the back of the room instead of paying attention in class, which was incredible. But, you know, I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't have any direction, but I sort of always thought I wanted to be a scientist. And then, like so many people, I decided instead that I wanted to be a physician. So I sort of focused on that in undergrad. And then, long story short, I ended up studying teaching biology actually in Tanzania, East Africa for 2 years. And then I finally went on to work in a lab for the first time, because at my undergrad institution, we didn't have labs that did research. It was a teaching institution. So then I went after Tanzania, I went and worked studying Plasmodium, the causative agent of malaria, which was sort of near and dear to my heart because I had malaria when I lived there. And then eventually I went to grad school and studied RNA regulation and the evolution of RNA binding proteins. And then now I find myself in Monica's lab, which is terrific. So like I said, it's been long, circuitous, but I think I've always known I wanted to be. I just didn't know what that meant.
Have you always worked with fruit flies then, even from when your biology teacher gave them to you? Or did you use some other models?
This is my actually my first foray into Drosophila. When I was working after a teaching, I worked in studying Plasmodium falciparum. So malaria, so that's, you know, kind of a cell culture. And then I moved into yeast when I went to graduate school, or I should say fungi. I studied a number of different species of fungi because I was doing an evolution study. So I studied, the classics, Pombi and Saccharomyces cerevisiae, but also a few more niche species. Neurospora crassa comes to mind. I've actually never really, I didn't, you know, I kind of played around with flies until this point, but now I feel like I know a little bit more about fly genetics. So this is kind of certainly my first experience, a real experience in flies.
What had brought you to Monica's laboratory to do your postdoctoral studies? Was there like a particular question you were attracted to, or a type of,
you know, absolutely. I really liked the question, and certainly the way Monica sort of approaches the question, this idea of neuroepigenetics, or, you know, how are the genes changing in the brain in relation to metabolism, and, you know, because we're really interested in sugar and how the environment affects the brain and how it can, change the way the brain functions. And I was actually lucky enough to see Monica speak in a seminar before I joined the lab, and it's just, you know, she's a terrific speaker, a very good mentor. I wasn't coming from a fly background, so I needed someone who was willing to take me and teach me fly genetics and all the powerful things that we can do with flies. So that was also something that I really liked about Monica's lab. You know, the energy, she's got a real passion for what we do, and it's infectious, and it's fun to work in that kind of environment. So it was kind of, once I found her, I think it was difficult to find her, but once I found her, I think it was pretty much a no-brainer. I've always wanted to be, you know, I really do believe in basic science. I think fundamentally we learn a lot about biology when we're not necessarily looking for things, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, but I did want to study something, you know, quote unquote, relevant to human disease. I think, you know, in this way, I can study just fundamental processes of the brain, but it really is, you know, there are implications for diabetes and how we eat and in obesity and all these metabolic disorders. So it's just a, yeah, it, like I said, it was a pretty easy decision. She's a good place. It's a good place for me.
That's fantastic. Yeah. As a person who just started as a postdoc as well, I can understand how important it is to find the right mentor. So that's fantastic.
It is. And it's not so easy. You know, it's hard, I think. I've known a lot of good graduate students who had struggled to get to great labs, and it takes some work, and it's, you don't get to do the rotation. So it's also a little scary.
Right. And there are more options.
There are more options often. Yeah, that's true.
You know, from everything I haven't seen Monica speak personally. I've heard she's a fantastic public speaker, and also she has a podcast as well.
A very good podcast. Definitely check it out. It's really interesting. Kind of peels back the layers, and you know, you can understand what scientists, where they come from, and how they think a little bit. And it's a great show. Yeah,
that's great. We really support more scientists doing podcasts. So we all know that science can't be as, you know, as linear as we have to write it in the paper. So what was the first question that you asked that started this body of work?
So this work actually originated before I joined the lab. I think the question was, why do they stop eating when they stop eating? You know, it kind of a big, more philosophical question, probably. Originally, there was this notion that Monica had that she wanted to take metabolomics and transcriptomics and behavior and combine them all into this kind of thesis of cohesion. And just, you know, it sounded like a kind of a magnus opus or something, you know, just very like beautiful and symphonic. But in the end, it's just so complicated. I think I don't have a very strong background in metabolism, but I think, you know, I definitely have an appreciation of how complicated it is particularly in the brain. It kind of fell out of this, and you know, RNA abundance often doesn't correlate with protein function. I think we often forget that. So that makes it really complicated to understand these data.
Speaking of metabolic function, you had mentioned that most of what was previously known about metabolism has to do with its energetic function. I'm wondering, what are some of the things that are known about the relationship between metabolism and the brain?
I think a lot of what we know about metabolism in the brain is, like you say, energetic. So we know that the brain consumes a lot of energy. I think it's something like 20% of the oxygen consumed in a mammal is from the brain. You know, obviously the brain is very energetically costly. You know, we need lots of ATP, constantly synthesizing new molecules. You know, running the pumps to maintain ion concentrations, all those things make it very energetically expensive to run a brain. And then there's this other side to it, that there's this big barrier between the circulation and how you get your energy in a multicellular organism into the brain. So the blood-brain barrier poses this sort of interesting problem, if you will. On one hand, it's protective. On the other hand, it prevents you from easily getting molecules across it. And then, of course, there's the added complication of, you know, just neurons don't do everything themselves. You know, astrocytes, glia are very important for metabolism. So a lot of what's been done is, you know, related to kind of energy function. How do you get glucose or I think lactate is probably, although there's some controversy around that, whether or not lactate is strictly used by neurons. How do you get that energy into the brain since it is so energetically taxing? So I think that's kind of what people have mostly studied because it's a bit easier. And then of course the additional complications that, you know, individual places or subsections of the brain will require different energetic or have different energetic needs.
So you'd mentioned that that your PI had this great big idea to compare the whole transcriptome and metabolome. And so you developed a really cool tool called FlyScape. So could you talk a little bit more about the idea behind that and what kind of information it tells us?
Oh yeah, that was actually pretty essential. At the time, we, you know, as I think with all of us who are doing these kinds of experiments, you know, these big omics experiments, it's difficult to put your head around, you know, anything that you can kind of make sense of. And at the time, there was no way to really visualize and think about the metabolites unless you had kind of had the metabolic, you know, all of metabolism kind of in your head. Just looking at lists of metabolites is really complicated. And you know, even if you are looking at maps of you know, pathways of metabolism, the pathways interact with each other. And so we were really interested in figuring out, you know, this sort of broadly metabolism in the brain. So we collaborated with Ala Troyanskaya's group, also here at Michigan, to develop the software that allows us to visualize Drosophila-centric, and so this has been done for mice and humans, but Drosophila-centric metabolic pathways, and then layer on top of that any other kind of data you wish. For instance, we use transcriptomic data, so RNA abundance data. But I think you could you know, just as easily add proteomics data or any other kind of omics data. And try to understand what's happening to the metabolism with an additional layer of context. Our hope was that if we looked at, say, the TCA cycle and saw that it was disrupted, would there be enzymes that are involved in TCA that are changing in abundant RNA abundance? In some cases, that did work. In other cases, it didn't work because those are post-translationally modified and the abundance doesn't necessarily correlate with function. So that was kind of the impetus.
Right.
It didn't exist, and it's a really complicated problem.
Yeah, and I think it's a problem a lot of labs face. As you mentioned, not many people really do proteomics. So their focus is mostly on RNA-seq at this point, with like looking at in a non-biased manner. So yeah, it's definitely a feat to try and tie the two.
Yeah, and it makes sense because RNA, you know, it's much easier to get the RNA in a form that we can amplify it and see it. It's much more difficult to do proteomic kind of approaches where we lose post-translational modifications and just getting enough material. It's hard to get material from a fly brain.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel, for your time and for joining us on today's episode of Top of the Noggin.
Thank you. It was fun. I appreciate it.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. If you're looking for other podcasts that interview scientists, we strongly encourage you to go out and listen to Cite Black Women Podcast, a biweekly podcast discussing the acknowledgement of Black women's ideas and intellectual contributions both inside and outside of academia. We also strongly encourage our socially active listeners to follow the hashtag #BlackInNeuro to tune into and follow the research of Black neuroscientists.
We encourage you to subscribe to our podcast and tell your friends about us. Please also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @NogginNYU. And join us in 2 weeks for a discussion about protein synthesis during memory consolidation with NYU's very own Dr. Priran Astrestha.